A few weeks ago, my wife and I were able to spend about 12 days in Germany and in Italy, and the trip was for the purpose of going and visiting the offices and the brethren there, getting to meet everyone and get a feel for how things are going in those two countries. I had a personal objective, having read recently a book on the United States of Europe that is rising by T.R. Reid. I was very intrigued by his analysis of things, and I wanted to just get a personal feel or sense, if you will, of what is happening in Europe, because we know that the major elements of prophecy for the future surround Europe and what is going to be happening then in the Middle East. It was very interesting talking with people and observing different things. There were many things that came to light. I thought I would mention a couple of observations that were both historically illuminating as well as current events that are rather intriguing to me. Both Germany and Italy are rather amazing countries, but for different reasons. The thing that was so striking about Germany is how they are the leading power and the dominant force in Europe today, and the prosperity that exists there today in light of being a nation that has risen from the devastation of two world wars in the last century. It is really amazing to go there and to see the power that exists within that country and the role that they are fulfilling in the world scene. I guess one of the more remarkable trips that we had was to be able to go to Berlin and to go into what used to be East Germany. A little over 16 years ago, the Berlin Wall fell on November 9th through the 12th, 1989. You can go into various tourist places there and buy pieces of the original wall that existed. It's not like when you go to the Middle East and to Jerusalem and there are so many pieces of the cross for sale that you could buy and build a small village out of it. These are authenticated, and the Germans have a very systematic way of approaching things, and I'm sure when they say this is authentic piece of the wall, it probably is. They're in various sizes. They cost different amounts, but I bought a few pieces. One of them that I sent to my son had a copy of a newspaper headline from 1989, and it was a quote by Erich Honecker, the East German leader at the time, that roughly translated said, "This wall will still be standing 100 years from now." That was 10 months before it fell. Now, I don't know if he was under delusion or just trying to give a pep talk to the people or if he really believed it. But apparently, whatever happened in his mind, everybody was taken by surprise at how swiftly the wall came down. It was quite interesting to stand on the same area by the Brandenburg Gates, where President Reagan had stood there previously and said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." And even though he said it, the events that took place to make it happen were rather stunning, and the speed with which it took place was rather remarkable. The wall was not just literal, it was also a symbol for the communist system in Europe falling and coming down, and it exposed the weakness of the general philosophy of communism. Immediately upon the fall, a building frenzy began. Our guide, Yasmina Alawa from the German office, said, "You should have been here." In the few months just following this, when the cranes, building cranes, were all over the skyline, and actually I went on the internet and looked up some photos, and just it seemed like scores of cranes because they went into a building program. And what used to be just this drab city that existed on the other side of the wall, it didn't take long for buildings to spring up, and office buildings and technology centers and entertainment centers have arisen there, all of them with a transformation that has been so fast as to almost be stunning, even to the German people who lived there. They still to this day are in awe of how fast it happened. While we were there, that's sort of a historical process that took place, but something happened also while we were there. That's when the protest and the furor over the cartoons being printed in the Danish newspapers blew up. And the entire Muslim world around the world started protesting, and in a violent way, protesting and showing their displeasure with what had taken place. And of course, the target this time was Europe, not the United States. And being there in Europe, it was very interesting at the time because, of course, this was coming on the heels of the riots that had taken place in France. But the reaction of the Muslim world just caught everybody off guard. But what was equally interesting was to see the reaction to their actions. Because in Europe, there was a considerable anti-Muslim sentiment that's been brewing for a long time, but really rose up quickly. You could hear it from business leaders, government leaders, journalists. This backlash that was created in the minds of the Europeans against the Muslim reaction. A lot of hard feelings going on right now. We've written about this in our literature. You can read about it in social commentary all over now. It served to illustrate a point and shape an observation as well that I could not help but consider Daniel 11:40, where it says the king of the south will push at the king of the north. And however that final configuration is going to occur, it's not hard to see when you get such a sensitive and divided world how quickly people can flare up at one another and can push. We use the phrase today, push somebody's buttons. You know, you hit the right nerve and you can cause a reaction. And we saw that taking place. And in a highly sensitive world, it's not hard to see how that can happen. And suddenly things can flare up that catch people off guard. It's interesting in Daniel 11:40, the translation for push at, it's translated in different ways. Some versions say butt at, like two goats butting at each other. Or others say to butt heads or to gore, even like an animal gores another animal. It's also translated to attack or to contend with. But it all conveys the image that there is an action there and there that creates an equal and opposite reaction. But the overall sense that was impressive to me was how quickly life can change and how quickly these things can come up. We saw that in our own country on September 11th, 2001. We woke up and it was just like any other day. It was not any other day to the perpetrators. September 11th had been picked and targeted for a long time. But for us, it was to take a major turn. In 1 hour, three major landmarks in the United States were hit. 2,000 people died. It wasn't the numbers so much that were impressive. It was when it happened and where it happened and why it happened that set the whole world on its ear, if you will. And we realized that day that our lives had changed. We've become probably more sensitized to that in the world today. When Katrina came along and so quickly devastated things, I remember hearing some commentators, and probably many of us thought the same thing, what if a major earthquake happened at the same time in another part of the country? As much as of a crisis that Katrina threw us into, what if we had something else happening? And we began to see and have impressed on our minds more than ever before how quickly we can be thrown into a crisis. All of this has had me considering recently an element of prophecy that I'm not sure we have focused on as much as we perhaps should have in the past, but it's certainly something that should not go unnoticed. We're going to walk today through a number of prophecies. Some of them have already been fulfilled in the past. Some of them are yet to be fulfilled in the future. Some of them in the past serve as types for what is going to happen in the future. Some of them were for Israel, some of them for both ancient and modern, and some of them for the Gentile nations. But through these, we're going to look at a certain element that is often at work. This is not going to be some kind of flash of insight. It's not going to set you abuzz with who's going to do what and when they're going to do it. It's not going to be that type of message. But it is going to be something that might save your life. It might save your life. We're going to see this concept that crops up fairly frequently in prophecy, especially end time prophecy, and something we need to have firmly planted in mind, because Sometimes, in considering all the details of prophecy, we may just miss this thing that is frequently mentioned, and sufficiently so that we should give it attention. Now about, probably 98-99% of this sermon is going to be about prophecy, you would think, but it's not really about prophecy. I'll explain that as we get toward the end. Let's go to the book of Isaiah chapter 5, the book of Isaiah chapter 5, where we will see this introduced. Isaiah 5, let's begin in verse 7 just to get a little context. In Isaiah 5 and verse 7, we read, "For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant plant. He looked for justice, but behold oppression, for righteousness, but behold weeping." And from this point on through the rest of the chapter, he begins to list a number of things that he says are woes to the country. Condemnations for the approach that is being taken in society, in ethics and morality, in breaking the law of God. And the conditions that he lists here that existed in Israel and Judah at this time it was given, as you read through here, you say these are eerily similar to what we find in society today. Verse 20 offers a pretty good summary. It says, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter." Do we have to understand what that means? I say just watch TV a little bit this week. And you will find people who are confused. Even in the religious world, they're confused over what is right, what is wrong, what is evil, and what is good. But that's an example. There are specifics written in here about the state of the nation. But he says troubles are going to come as a result of this. In verse 24, in the latter part of the verse, these troubles are going to come, he says, in the latter part of the verse, "because they have rejected the law of the Lord of hosts and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. Therefore, the anger of the Lord is aroused against his people. He has stretched out his hand against them and stricken them, and the hills trembled. Their carcasses were as refuse in the street, in the midst of the streets. For all this, his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still." Notice verse 26. "He will lift up a banner to the nations afar off, and will whistle to them from the end of the earth. Surely they shall come with speed, swiftly." And that brings up the little word or two that we're going to see interwoven through a number of places here today. The concept is speed and how fast things can happen. The swiftness with which things can happen. And coupled with that is going to be a sense of how people never cease to be stunned by the suddenness of when things happen, when they occur, how quickly, even if it's foretold well in advance, people never cease to be stunned, it seems like. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 30. In Isaiah 30, in verse 8, God inspired Isaiah again to write here, Isaiah 30, verse 8. "Now go, write it before them on a tablet, and note it on a scroll, that it may be for time to come forever and ever." God said, "I want this written. I don't want it to be as though I never told you. Don't give me that." He said, "Let's put it down here. We'll have a record of this, that this is a rebellious people, lying children, children who will not hear the law of the Lord, who say to the seers, 'Do not see,' and to the prophets, 'Don't prophesy to us right things.' We want you to speak to us, but speak to us smooth things. That's what we like to hear. Prophesy deceits. Get out of the way. Turn aside from the path. Cause the Holy One of Israel to cease from before us." Notice verse 12. Therefore, thus says the Holy One of Israel, because you despise this word, and trust in oppression and perversity, and rely on them, therefore this iniquity shall be to you like a breach, ready to fall, a bulge in a high wall, whose breaking comes suddenly, in an instant. God is simply telling Israel, you can accumulate sin, you can accumulate iniquity and oppression and perversity and all of these things, and there may not be an instant punishment for it. And you can start living a way of life that doesn't mean that everything falls apart immediately, but it's going to build a spiritual pressure. It's sin builds up, and he says that the way it's going to come about is like a breach, a bulge in a wall, where there's so much pressure on a wall that when that breaking comes, it comes suddenly and in an instant. You might have seen the news about the dam breaking in Hawaii this week. All of a sudden, you know, the pressure builds for a long time, but when the breaking comes, he says that is what is going to take place, that is how it's going to be. Go back to the Berlin Wall as an example. You know, the Berlin Wall's breaking was not precipitated suddenly. The fall came suddenly. The whole world was captivated watching it on the news. But the events leading up to it did not happen suddenly. These things were building over a long period of time. There was one historian who wrote, "The fall of the wall began the day it was built. Only it took 30 years for it to be torn down." In other words, the seeds of destruction were built into the system, and there was going to be so much, in that case, oppression was part of it, and perversity, that there was a backlash to it. And there was a struggle in the world, political scene, that eventually led to that wall being torn down. But it's also like the sins of a nation. Unrepented of, they can build for a while, life can go on, but when God calls for an accounting, the breaking comes suddenly. Let's go to chapter 48 of Isaiah. And yes, we're going through a bit of a chronological order. These are not all of the scriptures where the concept is found, but enough to begin to see the trend that is here. Isaiah 48, verse 1. "Hear this, O house of Jacob, who are called by the name of Israel, and have come forth from the wellsprings of Judah, who swear by the name of the Lord, and make mention of the God of Israel." It's not as though God is out of the picture. People can claim to be very religious. That doesn't mean they're very spiritual necessarily. They can call on God. They make mention of the God of Israel, but he says, "but not in truth or in righteousness. For they call themselves after the holy city and lean on the God of Israel. The Lord of hosts is his name. I have declared the former things from the beginning. They went forth from my mouth, and I caused them to hear it. Suddenly I did them, and they came to pass." Now God said, I've been declaring these things from the beginning. But when I step in and do it, it's like suddenly, all of a sudden, here it is. This sense of suddenness. It should not be unexpected. We've been told about what is coming for thousands of years. But if you don't expect it, it seems sudden. Let's go to Jeremiah chapter 4. He too carried this thought in the message that he had. Jeremiah 4. Jeremiah loved his nation. He loved his people. We've noted before how he was a patriot, if there was a patriot. But he was sent by God to give a message. And he said in verse 19, "Oh, my soul, my soul." This hurts me. He said, "I am pained in my very heart. My heart makes a noise in me. I cannot hold my peace." What was bothering him so much? "Because you have heard, O my soul, the sound of the trumpet, the alarm of war. Destruction upon destruction is cried, for the whole land is plundered. Suddenly, my tents are plundered, and my curtains in a moment. How long will I see the standard and hear the sound of the trumpet? My people are foolish. They have not known me. They are silly children, and they have no understanding. They are wise to do evil, but to do good they have no knowledge." Jeremiah said, I hear this trumpet. I see what is coming. And this plundering is going to take place suddenly. It's going to seem like just in a moment. In chapter 6, in verse 13. Chapter 6 and verse 13, he said, because from the least of them, even to the greatest of them, everyone is given to covetousness. And from the prophet, even to the priest, everyone deals falsely. They have also healed the hurt of my people slightly. Those who are responsible for guiding and shepherding the people, you know, they try to heal it, and they heal it in a slight way, but it's a wrong way. Because they say, peace, peace. God is saying, there is no peace. You're not understanding what the issue is. There is no peace. Were they ashamed when they had committed abomination? No, they were not at all ashamed, nor did they know how to blush. Therefore, they shall fall among those who fall. At the time I punish them, they shall be cast down, says the Eternal. Thus says the Eternal, stand in the ways and see. We should be able to stand and look at what is going on and see some things. And ask for the old paths where the good way is and walk in it. Then you will find rest for your souls. But they said, we're not going to go that way. We won't walk in it. I set a watchman over you, saying, listen to the sound of the trumpet. But they said, we're not going to listen. Therefore, hear, you nations, and know, O congregation, what is among them. Hear, O earth, behold, I will certainly bring calamity on this people, even the fruit of their thoughts, because they have not heeded my words nor my law, but rejected it. Let's drop down to verse 22. Thus says the Lord, behold, a people comes from the north country, and a great nation will be raised from the farthest parts of the earth. They will lay hold on bow and spear. They are cruel and have no mercy. Their voice roars like the sea, and they ride on horses, as men of war set in array against you, O daughter of Zion. We have heard the report of it. Our hands grow feeble. Anguish has taken hold of us. Pain is of a woman in labor. Don't go out into the field nor walk by the way because of the sword of the enemy. Fear is on every side. O daughter of my people, clothe yourself with sackcloth and roll about in ashes. Make mourning as for an only son, most bitter lamentation, for the plunderer will suddenly come upon us. There is a sense even, the people that could sense that something was happening out there. There was an enemy there, but they weren't making the connection to repent before God. And when the enemy came, he was going to come suddenly. This happened with Judah and Israel. They both went into captivity in a very terrible way. There's a historical precedent, in other words, for things that happened in the past, the message that was sent, and yet when the things came about, it shocked people, caught them by surprise before they reacted the way they should have. Also in the Old Testament are thoughts about what is coming in the future. Let's go to Zephaniah chapter 1. Zephaniah chapter 1. Zephaniah 1 deals with the prophecy of the great day of the Lord. And we see this intervention from God also being described in the way that we've been talking about. Verse 14, the great day of the Lord is near. It is near and hastens quickly. The noise of the day of the Lord is bitter. There the mighty men shall cry out. Notice verse 18. Neither their silver nor their gold shall be able to deliver them in the day of the Lord's wrath. But the whole land shall be devoured by the fire of his jealousy, for he will make speedy riddance of all those who dwell in the land. Now the great day of the Lord describes the events that lead up to and surround the return of Christ. What we see in all of these places that we look at is that when God determines that it is time to act, when it is time for him to move, he is not delayed by anything. He moves. Humans can sometimes take years to construct what their plans may be, but it doesn't take God years. He can do it whenever he plans to do it, and nothing will stand in his way. The second thing you see is that so often people are caught off guard by the suddenness of unfolding events, even if they have been warned. When Christ returns, it's going to be a shock to the world. We won't turn there, but Malachi 3 and verse 1 says, "The Lord whom you seek." Do you seek the return of Christ? Do we in this room seek Christ's return? It says, "The Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple." What does that mean? He will suddenly come. Well, we've been looking forward to that for 2,000 years. But he says it's going to be a sudden coming. It says, "Behold, he is coming," says the Lord of hosts. There is something that we're being told here, something that we're supposed to pick up on as we go through these verses and these concepts about speedy riddance, hastening quickly, coming suddenly. Before we go out of Zephaniah, let's go right on into chapter 2 briefly, because connected with this concept of speed is another concept that we will see emphasized a great deal. And we'll see that momentarily in the New Testament, but here it is in the prophecy of Zephaniah as well, chapter 2 and verse 1. "Gather yourselves together, yes, gather together, O undesirable nation, before the decree is issued, before the day passes like chaff, before the Lord's fierce anger comes upon you, before the day of the Lord's anger comes upon you. Seek the Lord, all you meek of the earth, who have upheld his justice. Seek righteousness. Seek humility. It may be that you will be hidden in the day of the Lord's anger." What he is saying in chapter 1 is here's what is going to happen. What he's saying in chapter 2 at the beginning is there ought to be a certain type of response to that. There ought to be a response to that. Now let's move on. Keep this idea in mind because we'll see it momentarily. Going on in our study of suddenness, we come to perhaps a more familiar prophecy, Mark chapter 13. Mark 13. In this prophecy, answering the question that the disciples asked of what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age, one of the things that Jesus pointed out we find in verses 32 through 37. He said, "Of that day and hour no one knows, neither the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. Take heed, watch, and pray, for you do not know when the time is." He said, let me illustrate. It's like a man going to a far country who left his house and gave authority to his servants and to each his work and commanded the doorkeeper to watch. Now, we've never had a difficulty understanding the parallels in this parable. Christ is the one going to the far country. He has his church and he gave authority to his servants to do a work. And he said, watch. Verse 35, "Watch, therefore, for you do not know when the master of the house is coming, in the evening, at midnight, at the crowing of the rooster, or in the morning." And why? Why should we watch? Lest coming suddenly, which Malachi 3:1 says, coming suddenly, he finds you sleeping. "And what I say to you, I say to all, watch." This is a very powerful statement. Now let's consider a little point to ponder for a few minutes. When you think about this, suddenness, this whole concept of suddenness seems in large part to be a matter of perception, doesn't it? What do I mean by that? Well, we read the Old Testament examples there about trumpets blowing and being warned. and you have people being shocked. Was everybody shocked at the events that took place when Israel and Judah fell? I don't think Jeremiah was. Let's go to a modern example. On 9/11, was everybody in the world shocked at what took place? Most were. Al-Qaeda wasn't. The people who had been planning all of this for several years weren't shocked. They were rejoicing before the planes even hit. They knew what was coming. Their plan was being rolled out just like they had figured it would be. Those who were shocked were the ones who were caught completely off guard, who didn't think something like this could happen, had not anticipated it. We were stunned as a nation, as a world. Now, when it comes to Christ's return, is everybody going to be shocked at his coming suddenly? The element of suddenness and surprise is a matter of perception, and most of the world will be. Is God going to be shocked? Is God going to be taken aback by how sudden it is? The Father knows. We just saw that. The Father knows. He knows exactly what's coming. He's telling his people here, the message here is, don't you be surprised too. Don't be surprised. He's told us this. We read this. Christ himself was saying these words. It's not going to catch God the Father. It's not going to catch Jesus Christ, his Son, by surprise. Is God going to someday be sitting on his throne and say, you know, Son, let's do it right now. Go, let's get you down there. I'm in a good mood this morning. I'm in a bad mood, however he may be. I've got a whim. You know, sometimes I surprise myself how fast I make decisions. You don't see God that way, do you? The plan of God is going to roll out right on schedule. But he said when it rolls out, most people are going to be stunned, even though they've been told. He's telling us something here. Where does this sense of suddenness come in? Well, implicit in what Jesus is saying here is that the human mind is very prone to being distracted. The human mind is very prone to being taken off task. And he's saying that we, his people, really need to take heed and watch, or we too could be stunned by the suddenness with which events will take place. God's known that it's coming, and we have too. We have these words that are given to us. We've known for thousands of years. And yet embedded in so many prophecies, he keeps saying, but it's going to catch people off guard. The suddenness and the swiftness by which it happens is just going to be a shock to the system. And I want you to stay awake and don't fall prey to the temptation to sleep. He's very strong here. You know, another thing about this section and how strong he was, you know, we all consider ourselves blessed to have this word preserved for us. And these words are spirit and they are life, you know, and it gives us everything that we put our hopes on. But when you read accounts like this, there's one thing that pen and paper can't do. As you read it, it cannot convey the intensity with which Christ was speaking. It cannot convey the tone of his voice, the gestures he was using. We don't see the picture. And I just wonder if we would have been sitting there and would have been listening to him. How was he saying these words? Was he propped up against a tree, just sort of chit-chatting with them? Or was he maybe standing there and walking around to them, leaning into their faces? How intense was he in trying to get this across to them? What sense of urgency do you get out of the way that these words are written if you try to picture how he was saying them? If he was standing here today giving this message, what would he sound like? I think he was then, and I think he would be doing everything that he could now to convey the seriousness of what this is all about. When you read Zephaniah 2, 1 through 3, which we just read, did you get a sense of urgency in that? When he was pleading with his people, seek righteousness, seek humility, and maybe you can be hidden from these things. Do you get a sense of urgency here? If you don't, well, consider this parable about the same issue, Matthew chapter 25. In Matthew 25, he illustrates it from the other side of the coin. It's not his words. He's telling us about the way it's going to be from the mouths of people. In Matthew 25, in the first 13 verses, we have the parable of the wise and the foolish virgins. And you know the story. They all have oil in their lamps. At midnight, verse 6, a cry was heard, "The bridegroom is coming, go out and meet him." They all rose, they trimmed their lamps, and the foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil because our lamps are going out." And they said, "You can't do that. You can't give somebody else the Spirit of God that's in you. It's for each person to maintain." And so while they went to buy, the bridegroom came. And those who were ready went in with him to the wedding, and the door was shut. And the other virgins came saying, how do you read this here? If you were going to film a movie of how this would be, how would you be directing the people to portray this? When they say, "Lord, Lord, open to us," how do you think they were saying that? Are they begging? Are there tears? Is there a desperation? I think when they read this, or when they would be saying that, there was a plea that was going out because they sensed something. They went out to buy, the bridegroom is here, and they aren't ready. And they said, "Lord, Lord, open to us." And he said, "I don't know you." That is just as scary as can be, isn't it? To invest everything that we have in this and then get to a point where he says, I really don't know you. What is the depth of feeling in their voice? What is the desperation or the angst or the concern that they have? And again, how urgently was he trying to get this concept across? I don't even feel like trying to imitate what it would be like. It's totally inadequate to try to capture the scene in which this would be played out. So in verse 13, he said, "Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming." Watch therefore. Don't let it catch you off guard. Don't let it be something that seems so sudden as to shake us to the point that we could later say, "How could I have missed that?" There's one message that comes through loud and clear when you read these accounts in Mark 13 and Matthew 25. There's a lesson in this. We know enough from prophecy to know the events, the general events and the course of events. We know what those are that are going to come upon the world. The lesson is we will either have a sense of urgency before they happen or we will have a sense of panic when they happen. We will either have a sense of urgency before or a sense of panic afterwards. Those who do not have a sense of urgency are going to be stunned by the suddenness with which things unfold. And when they realize what it means, the panic reaction is going to kick in. God tells us what is going to happen. But he also says that people will be shocked when it does. The late reaction to the event. Now, this makes the point that I was referring to earlier in the message today. This sermon really is not about prophecy. It's about our reaction to prophecy. It's about what does it do to us in the mind. When we read these things, when we are aware of what is going on, how do we respond to it? The personal lesson, the lesson that each person takes and integrates into their own lives and their own feelings, the personal lesson that is embedded in these statements here has to do with our mindset. And either we will read prophecy and look at these things and keep our eyes open and have a sense of urgency about the way of God, or we'll have a sense of panic afterwards. The word urgency simply means pressing, crucial, critical, requiring immediate attention, first priority, paramount. The word panic means fear, alarm, loss of composure, terror. I think that's what Christ was trying to get across. Paul also addressed this in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, beginning in verse 1, he says, "But concerning the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I should write to you." Saying, look, we have knowledge. There's a knowledge of the course of events. But here's what he did write to them about. He said, "For you yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night." That's knowledge because we've already read it. We read it in Christ's words. The problem is not in having knowledge. The problem is how different people respond to the knowledge. "For when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them, as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they shall not escape." It's very similar wording as to what we read in Isaiah and Jeremiah. "But you, brethren, are not in darkness, so that this day should overtake you as a thief. You are all sons of light and sons of the day. We are not of the night nor of darkness. Therefore," let's make sure we don't go there. "Therefore, let us not sleep as others do, but let us keep watch and be sober. For those who sleep, sleep at night, and those who get drunk are drunk at night. But let us who are of the day be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and as a helmet, the hope of salvation." Sudden destruction is going to come upon a world. It's going to be a world that's asleep at the wheel. The word sudden doesn't have any trick meanings in it. You know, you can look it up. There's nothing subtle about it. There's nothing that can be mistranslated. The word sudden here in the Greek means sudden. It means unexpected, unawares. And Paul was simply saying, we know it's going to catch the world this way, but don't let it catch you. Now you might think, how in the world could we of all people be caught asleep? Well, there are several factors. I think of four right off the bat. Ignorance. Of course, we shouldn't be ignorant, but you can understand how in an ignorant world they'll be caught asleep. Deceit. Sometimes people are not ignorant, but they've been deceived about the knowledge that they do have. Skepticism is one. Apathy can be another. You can take any one of those by themselves, and they can set up someone to be shocked when God steps in. You put all four of them together, and it can really set up a world, a condition that is blinding. When it came to skepticism, Peter addressed the church in that way too in 2 Peter 3. And he said there, he said, "I wish to stir you up. I wish to stir you up to remember what has been said. Because," he said, "this is sure. Scoffers will come in the last days, walking according to their own lust." And what are they going to be scoffing about? Peter said, they're going to be saying, "Where is the promise of his coming? This sudden coming, you know, hasn't been so sudden, has it?" They're going to be scoffing. There's going to be an attitude set in. Everything's going just like it always has been. Peter identified that as one of the problems in the last days, when people will be taking on an attitude, "Let's not get too upset. Let's not get buggy. Let's not get wide-eyed. Let's don't worry too much because, you know, things always been the way they are." Why was Peter inspired to write that? If it's not something that God says, this is something I want the church to be aware of. Last week we were in Houston for the 50th church anniversary, and I think everybody who went did a lot of reflecting about what it was like back in the day, you know. It was year 50. We started attending in year 7, and Nobody at that time had any idea we'd be around for the 50th anniversary. When we came into church, somebody who'd been in the church for 7 years was a grizzled old veteran, you know. But here we are. And as I was thinking about those early days, I remember one of the first things I heard as a kid coming into the church was, watch and pray. And you know, after 43 years, the skeptic's heart could say, yeah, I've been watching for 43 years, and things are better now than they used to be. The scoffer could go in that direction. You could slip right into a spiritual stupor. Stupor is pretty close to stupid, isn't it, as far as a word goes. People have done that. Some have become cynical and weary in well-doing. Some became impatient. They became, pulled away by the lust of the world and cares of this life. People have become scoffers. But you know what the inspiring thing was about that weekend? Was seeing so many people who've been around for decades, and they have maintained a sense of urgency. They're not bug-eyed. They're not weird. They're not out on the fringe. They're not stressed out by life, but they have kept very sober about what they're living for and why they are, and they keep their eyes on the goal that God has set before them and upon His way. There are many people who have done that. They've kept their priorities right. Part of that weekend was spent reflecting on some who have died in the faith. Sort of like Hebrews 11, where they have not received the promises yet. They went to their graves with a sense of urgency. Was that wasted? Well, not at all, because you look at their lives and you realize it was having a sense of urgency that helped them maintain a healthy spiritual state of life. It is so critically important, no matter what day and age we live in. You can see that there are some very strong words directed to the church, that we know these things. Don't be caught up in a condition that it will be stunning and surprising how suddenly things unfold. Now, let's go back to one other condition that's going to exist. That's the most of this addresses the church, but there is also a parallel condition that will address the world. If you go back to Isaiah chapter 47, we have here a prophecy of Babylon. There was a nation of Babylon, and it played a significant role in prophecy being fulfilled in the past. And there will be a latter-day Babylon representing the world structure that will exist at the return of Christ. In Isaiah 47, notice this about Babylon as Isaiah prophesied it in verse 8. Isaiah 47, 8. Therefore, hear this now, you who are given to pleasures, who dwell securely, who say in your heart, I am, there's no one else besides me. I shall not sit as a widow, nor shall I know the loss of children. He said, these two things shall come to you in a moment, in one day. The loss of children and widowhood. They shall come upon you in their fullness because of the multitude of your sorceries, for the great abundance of your enchantments. For you have trusted in your wickedness. You see, this wickedness can build up, but it'll be like the breach in the wall. The pressure on the wall, and its breaking will come suddenly. And he goes on, you have said, no one sees me. Your wisdom and your knowledge have warped you. And you have said in your heart, I am, and there is no one else beside me. Therefore, evil shall come upon you. You shall not know from where it arises. And trouble shall fall upon you, and you will not be able to put it off. And desolation will come upon you suddenly, which you shall not know. Now, that's an interesting prophecy, because when you go back to Revelation 18 in the latter day Babylon, there are some interesting things said here. As you turn there, let me speak to you a moment about some comments that Mr. Carmelo Anastasi made to me. We were driving down the road one day, and I asked him, what's the mood in Europe? Are Europeans, are they caught up in all of this European Union focus? He said, no. The average person in Europe, they leave that to the politicians. The politicians take care of all that stuff. They are caught up in all the benefits. They're caught up in a time like we've never had before. He pointed out, when is the last time in history that you can remember that Europe has had 60 years of peace? Europe's always been at war, it seems like. He said, we are not only have we had 60 years of peace, we are in a golden age of unprecedented prosperity throughout Europe. This is coming on the heels of the two worst wars in history that devastated us. He said, but the European look around and say, look how quickly we've rebuilt. Look how well things are. Look how rich we are. He said, Europeans don't need God. There's no sense of a need for God. So that's the mood of Europe these days. Well, that's a condition that makes the element of surprise all the more stunning, isn't it? In Revelation 18, when it describes here the system, this Babylon the Great that's going to exist, that is going to have created the richness of the world, a system which in verse 4 we are told to come out of, lest we share in her sins and receive of her plagues, because it is a sinful system. But it'll be a system that has built a very powerful condition of wealth and influence in the world. But notice, dropped into this chapter, four different places, notice the language. Verse 8, therefore her plagues will come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she shall be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judges her. Now, I don't think we need to quibble over whether it is a 24-hour period or what, but this language means it's quick. It'll come in one day. It's going to be very fast. And then the kings of the earth, it says, they're going to be amazed. They're going to be watching this. But verse 10, they're standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, alas, alas, that great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. 1 hour. Look, that's amazing to them. In verse 17, then we have the merchants, all the people who have become rich by this system. They're marveling, and in verse 17 it says, for in 1 hour such great riches came to nothing. And then in verse 19, they threw dust on their heads and cried out, weeping and wailing and saying, alas, alas, that great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth. For in 1 hour she is made desolate. You read this and you begin to think, why does that keep stressing that? The message that seems to be conveyed is that it's not only what happens, but how fast it happens. That the speed with which these things take place and the system falls is just incredible to people. Shouldn't surprise us. You read about it back in Isaiah. Coupled along with the political economic system, we also know is going to be the church system. When we were in East Berlin, there's an interesting sight as you walk down the famous street, Unter den Linden. You cross a bridge and you see two buildings. On the left side of the road is the Kaiser Wilhelm Cathedral, a massive church. In the crypts in the basement of that church are 50 members of the Hohenzollern family. Well, maybe it's more than that. The famous kings, the famous family that built Germany. Right across the street from it is the Palace of the Republic. The Palace of the Republic was built in 1976. It's a new building, frankly. And that was built to be the headquarters for the communist government. When that building was built, the communists wanted to tear down the church because obviously the church stood as a symbol of everything that communism stood against. And they were laying plans to do that, but the engineers came back to them. They said, because these buildings are built on an island in the river, if you tear down this church, you will destabilize the ground around it so much that you'll compromise all the other buildings, including the Palace of the Republic. So they couldn't tear it down. They had to leave this big church standing there. So here they are, right across the street from each other. This beautifully architected, architected a word, this beautifully sculpted and magnificent structure. And then this drab, I mean, it fit the system. It's just concrete and steel and glass, rectangular building. So it had to exist side by side. In addition to the wall falling in 1989, in 1990, the palace had to be shut down because they discovered it was full of asbestos. And they couldn't occupy it anymore. So for a number of years, it's been abandoned, it's been gutted, it's run down, it's ugly, it's got graffiti sprayed on it. In January of this year, the legislature in Germany decided that they would just tear it down. It's sort of symbolic. It sends a statement to a lot of people that here's the old church that existed long before, has gone through several governmental changes, outlasted communism, and it's like it sends a message. Governments will come and go, but the church will always be here. The church is always here. And it always has been there for 2,000 years almost. But you know, that's going to be part of the picture that's going to stun people as well. The false church system is going to fall suddenly, and that too will add to the chaos and confusion in the world. Well, one thing is very clear. The element of suddenness and surprise is woven throughout prophecy, and the lesson is clear. The lesson is very clear. We will have a sense of urgency before, or we will have a sense of panic afterwards. With that in mind, let's close with Luke 21. Luke's version of what we read in Mark 13 and Matthew 25. Luke adds just a little bit more to it. Luke 21, verse 34. But take heed to yourselves. He's saying that after discussing all of these prophetic events that are going to be taking place. He said, now, once we have this knowledge, take heed to what your reaction is. Think about how do I respond to the news of what is coming. Lest your hearts be weighed down with what is going to weigh down everybody else's hearts in the world, carousing, drunkenness, the cares of this life. And that day come on you unexpectedly. We know it's going to be unexpected on the world, but he said, don't let it come on you unexpectedly. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch, therefore, and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. So this sermon is really pretty simple. It's just to do what he said and to know why we need to do it. Watch. Watch for the kingdom of God. Keep your eyes on the kingdom of God and know what is coming. And also keep your eyes on what is happening in the world around so that we have an understanding of prophecy being fulfilled. And also keep your eye on the rearview mirror of history to learn the lessons from people who stood as witnesses to how suddenly events can unfold when God decides to intervene. And if we are watching, those who have a sense of urgency will not experience that sense of panic when all these things come to pass.